Dominicello is president and co-founder of Umbra, a remote sensing company on a mission to deliver global omniscience with its constellation of synthetic aperture radar satellites. Gabe, welcome to the Splinter.
Thank you. It is great to be on.
So, Gabe, I'd like to begin with a question that will help our audience understand where Umbra falls within the broader Earth observation market and what makes it special. No doubt, many of our listeners will be familiar with traditional electro-optical camera-style Earth observation companies that essentially take pictures of the world from space. How is Umbra different from a technical standpoint?
So if you think about an optical sensor, we have optical sensors in our face, our eyes, which require light in order to be able to see. Think of radar like a bat, where a bat sends out an echo and then listens to the echo. We do a very similar thing with our satellites, where we send out a radio wave, bounce it off Earth, catch it moving 22,000 miles an hour, and measure the distance. And through that measurement, we can produce a black and white image, which is pretty neat.
And just to get a sense of scale for the company and where you guys are operating at currently, how many satellites are currently in orbit?
8. I think we have 2 more going up in a few months, so we'll be 10 pretty soon.
In terms of the tech, I know that SAR technology enables more than just imaging. It's also a tool for Earth monitoring, for sort of understanding the patterns of human life on the surface of the planet as they evolve over time. And in a company press release, this capability was described as allowing, quote, precise measurements to understand if there's oil running through a pipeline, if a vehicle is on or off, if there's power passing through a power line, and even detect human footsteps on grass, all from space and without direct human involvement, which sounds like science fiction. How exactly is that kind of monitoring possible?
Well, you said it. It is a very, very precise measurement. So radar, at its face value, is very, very precise. So you need to know exactly where the signal is and exactly where your satellite is, and that measurement's very, very precise. And with that precision, you can use something called what's called vibometry, which allow you to look at an oil pipeline to see if it's vibrating, because you will see a difference in the signal. Or to detect a human footstep, you would use something called INSAR, interferometry, which allows you to take 2 images and then subtract the difference. It's a pretty unique tool.
Does this, by way of analogy, is this similar to taking 2 photographs in sort of rapid succession and then comparing one against the other, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, interferometry, you would have to have an identical collection. So, I mean, I don't know how much we want to bore your listeners with physics, but I'm happy to go into it. So if you're on the same orbital track with with 2 systems, you're able to subtract the 2 images. But you need to have almost identical geometry.
From a business standpoint, in the words of your colleague, Joe Morrison, the hardest part of building a satellite imagery company isn't the satellite imagery part, it's the company part. You got to sell stuff to people for more than it costs you to make it. Unit economics is something you're known for and have spent a long time thinking about. As described by a previous guest, Bern Hobart, quote, unit economics really shine as an analytical tool because they let you convert all the complexity of a company into a fairly simple formula. Do you have a formula for Umbra success in that respect?
Just make money. So, I mean, it really is simple. You just have to make money. And I have observed in the industry where you had a lot of companies that went out with a big vision, and you need a big vision to raise money from investors in most cases, specifically Silicon Valley, because it's, you have to understand the scale of capital. So it makes much more sense to take a bigger bet with like $100 million that becomes $10 billion than $1 million that becomes $10 million. We were always hyper logical on what was possible. So we said, look, we're not going to, how do I put this? We're not going to tell you a fantasy. We're going to tell you something simple. There's customers in the market. They're buying the data for this much. we believe that this invention that we made can produce data and we can sell it for much less. And, you know, our secret sauce is our satellites are have an ability to take far more images than anyone else with a radar satellite. So you don't make money just taking random pictures of Earth. Like, I don't know, open ocean, there's very, very little demand and or desired by open ocean. But super high demand areas, of which there's, you know, 5 to 10, there's somewhat like close to unlimited demand for data. So our invention allows us to cluster collections in such a way that we can take just far more pictures. But what that boils down to for our investors is we make 10 to 15 times more money. And because we make more money, we don't need to raise capital in the same way. We don't need to grow in the same way. And we can be really focused on just taking pictures and making more money.
You mentioned 5 to 10 high demand areas, which sounds like relatively few. What do those high demand areas amount to just on the surface of the planet? Are these like entire countries that you're referencing or regions? What's the scale?
Yeah. So you're thinking like a good example would be the Middle East is a high demand area.
And what dictates demand? Is it commercial interest or government interest or a mix of both?
So the vast majority of our customers is the U.S. government. And then second, we have allied foreign governments. We don't sell to non-allies. And then you have commercial, which is a much smaller portion, but it's everything you hear about, like counting trees, or if you go on our Twitter, looking at volcanoes or walruses or whatever it is that people always talk about, the stock traders who like count all the cars in the Walmart parking lots. I think the reason why it is that way is because you have the data is really expensive. The prices on our website, our least expensive image is $500. Our most expensive image is $3,000 and listed on the website. We have much more expensive imagery. It's not listed on the website. So there's kind of not a lot of people who can buy that other than like a government, an insurance company, an oil company. The mom and pop shop can't really justify that. Not yet anyway. We'd have to reduce prices more.
Stepping back to unit economics, when it comes to good unit economics for remote sensing companies like yours, what matters more, producing an abundance of supply or producing high resolution data?
You have to do both. You can't get away with one. If you have a whole bunch of like really low resolution imagery, it doesn't matter. So right now the biggest use case is the use case that a government would want it for. And that typically is not broad area collection. So I'd say resolution is pretty important.
If it's not broad area collection, can you give us a sense of what the sort of minimum viable resolution is for a company like yours in that use case?
If you're not doing below 50 centimeters, there's not really a point. You can't really see stuff. So a good, let me explain it. So they did a study, MIT Lincoln Lab did a study, and they were looking at large vehicles. And they were looking at it with 1 meter. With 1 meter imagery, the machine learning algorithm was able to pick up what kind of vehicle it was something like 47% of the time. So worse than a coin toss. They brought that resolution down to 50 centimeters, and it went to 97% of the time. And that's large vehicles. So if you get into smaller vehicles, you need much, much higher resolution. You need a quarter meter minimum.
Taking a step way back into just data economics in general, one of the common themes today in the tech world is so-called commodification of data, which is sometimes expressed as the idea that data is the new oil. It's a line that most people in the industry hate because, first of all, they quibble with the specifics of the analogy, but also because it implies that their products are just these basic, very fungible inputs to a more complex, high-value add industry. But I've actually heard you embrace the idea of data commodification many times. Why do you think there's such a pushback on that understanding of the product?
I used to hate it. So before we had a satellite that took more images than anybody else, I used to hate it. And the reason for that is a lot of data providers believe what they do is special. And the reality is all of us data providers in remote sensing sell a moment in time. That's what our product is. And the reality is that there's a lot of moments in time and not a lot of satellites that take these kinds of pictures. So right now it's somewhat scarce. I know Joe Morrison has definitely said like, it's not a commodity. but I think as time goes on and the technology and data becomes more proliferated and you have a lower barrier to entry, which is through lower pricing, the data will become commoditized. But now I don't care about it because we take so many more pictures. And our unit cost is so low relative to everybody else. And our output is so high that there's no, you couldn't really catch up. Even if somebody came in and they had a bunch of funding or whatever, they would have to meet our constellation size and the output of the satellites. So it's just not a threat. You just have to, and then you just have to continue to innovate. Like our next system is like every satellite we've launched has been better than the previous one. These two going up, I think around summer are way better than 7 and 8. And 7 and 8 are the like the, by far the best satellites we've ever done, and certainly the best in the commercial market. And it's been that way since satellite 4. So we're kind of only competing against ourselves in that sense.
I've read that your previous satellites were kind of pushing up against the physical limits of what was possible in terms of resolution.
No, legal limits.
Understood. And so in what respect are these new satellites better?
So how do I explain it? The physical limits of using radio waves to take pictures are even much better than our 15 centimeter data. You would just need to increase the bandwidth to much, much higher. But there are a lot of rules and regulations against through the FCC on what bands you can use. We work really closely with the government, really love the government. The government has been really supportive of us and our data release and the data we release. And they'll continue to be supportive. They're not going to stop innovation. I think that they just, in the early days, they didn't believe that two guys in a garage would do 1200 megahertz. This is like patently absurd. It's like weird.
Speaking of regulation and that being an unlock for the company, I know that a first major unlock happened in 2021 when you were granted the right to produce and sell SAR data at a resolution of 16 centimeters, which made Umbra the first commercial satellite provider in U.S. history to receive a license enabling that level of capability. So can you share a bit about how Umbra came about becoming the first to get that regulatory approval? And second, in your opinion, to what extent does this kind of regulatory approval give Umbra a competitive edge?
So we actually received a 25 centimeter license way back when maybe it was only two people or maybe like five. But what happened was we launched satellites that were better than what the regulators had given us. And, you know, we knew it was physically possible, but we didn't really understand how good the data would be. We thought it like we thought what's called the noise. So like the kind of, if you look at radar imagery, it can look really crisp or it can look somewhat grainy. We thought the graininess of it wouldn't really be a true, you know, 15 centimeter image. So we didn't even really think about it. And then as time went on, we started producing the data. We talked to regulators. Regulators got really comfortable with it. And then just released everything. Like they modified the license several times. And they're like, oh, well, it's just, who cares? This is America. We're going to let the Americans be the best. And they did. In terms of like a competitive edge, I believe that license would be awarded to anyone who can do it. But they got to figure it out, and it's not easy. I mean, literally billions and billions of dollars has been bet on other providers. And probably the least amount of money has been bet on us in terms of like our ability to succeed. And no one else has figured it out yet.
Taking a step back, you had mentioned that a company like yours sells a point in time. What does that mean for the value of all the previously taken images that sit in the archive? What's the value of the archival data versus a fresh new photo? And how would you price the difference between the two?
Well, this is a big debate internally, but I will answer the question philosophically. And I'll answer it philosophically as the founder of Umbra, which is you have a lot of people with very, very constrained supply, where over a high demand area, they're only taking a couple of images, one or two. And when we're taking 10 to 15, we just have way more supply. So we're highly incentivized to encourage people to get fresh imagery. So with like supply and demand elasticity, we can lower prices. Like our price list is significantly lower than anybody else's, at least publicly. And allowing customers to get the best product at the lowest price has been a big win for us. I mean, we've done really well this year. I think probably better than anyone else.
To talk about one final product that's in Umbra's offering, we've talked about imagery, we've talked about monitoring. There's also an RF sensing use case. Can you say a bit more about that and what it entails?
Probably not. So we have publicly won a study contract with the National Reconnaissance Office on listening to signals. So we can actively emit a radio wave, but we can also passively receive radio waves. Receiving radio waves allows you to, in quotes, listen to the radio wave and try and locate it.
My understanding of this is that it would be like looking at the dark ocean and seeing a ship using its radar, which from far away up in space kind of looks like a lighthouse emitting a signal. And that is a form of information. Is that the long and short of it? Or is there...
That's a much better way to explain it than me.
Okay, gotcha. Beyond innovating on the technical front, Umbra has also made a big name for itself thanks to its pretty unique business model, specifically the way in which you've revolutionized the customer experience across three fronts: tasking, pricing, and licensing. But before we dive into each of those, can you give us a sense for what the experience of purchasing satellite data was like pre-Umbra?
Well, I mean, still currently. Like, if I remember, we used to, Joe Morrison, I forget who, just like somebody new came and they were like, getting a satellite image can't possibly be that hard. And we're like, here's the Umbra credit card, buy a satellite image. And they couldn't do it. Like, they literally could not do it. It has gotten much easier with companies like SkyFi. I don't know if you talked to Luke. But buying data is really hard. And the reason why is it is so expensive. So for a 50 centimeter image, you're paying anywhere from $4,000 to $7,000, maybe even $10,000, depending on latency, from some of the other providers. But this goes back to supply and demand. Because we have so much supply, we don't have to treat the data in such a way that it is so special. So we can commoditize it to a certain extent. And the way that we commoditize it is we just allow people to task the satellite. So of course, there's a process to like be able to task our satellite. But once you get through the process, then you can task it as, you know, as much as you want. And, you know, so long as you're not an adversary of the United States.
So let's dive into that tasking aspect then to start. What is that tasking process like?
I mean, I can show you, or I can provide a video, but it is like, it is as easy as ordering an Uber. You go to a map, you pick where you want on the map, you select a task, which is like what resolution, what geometry, and then you hit send and a message goes to the satellite and the satellite takes a picture for you. It's neat.
I've read that in addition to being that easy, once users submit a tasking request, Umbra commits to never bumping that customer from the collection schedule in favor of another. But I'm curious, what happens if there's an especially urgent request that comes in, for example, from a government wanting to collect data in response to a natural disaster? Do they have to wait in line like everyone else?
Well, so I'll put it this way. Radar is an extremely dependable source, right? You can see through clouds, you can see at night and during a storm, like it is really, really dependable. When you task a radar image, you know exactly what you're getting, exactly when you are getting it, which is very different from optical because there's environmental factors like clouds, reflections, shadows, whatever, which would impact the image. So you're kind of, you don't really expect to get exactly what you ordered every time. With radar, you do. If you eliminate bumping, like as a strong philosophy of an organization, your customers know that they can always depend on you. And it doesn't matter. So if somebody goes, I'll give you $1 million for the task, we don't care. Because it is about our relationship with our customer. Our customer is really, really important to us. That being said, because we take so many pictures, we're able to do it, right? So if we only took two pictures, like that, like, so it's not to say that that business model doesn't work for people, the bumping. Like if you have a really constrained supply, you're going to bump people and you're going to make as much money as possible flying over a high demand area. But when you have abundant supply, you're not really doing it.
How responsive is your constellation today? Like what's the minimum wait time for mobilizing a satellite over a specific region?
So we have, so this is not commercially available, but we've tasked and delivered an image within 5 minutes. But you have to have like constant contact with the ground stations, that sort of thing. I would say that like regular service, it depends on the geometry and where you order it, but 6 hours, you know, kind of any point on Earth. I've definitely seen it under two. Just depends.
And when it comes to licensing, what kind of restrictions apply to the sale of your satellite data? You sort of hinted at a vetting process that comes before the tasking stage. Can you say a bit more about that?
So it's the vetting process. We just have to make sure that you are who you say you are. There's not like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who buy this kind of data. We kind of know everyone. But I think what is really special about our license isn't what the government gave us, it is what we give our customers. So we allow our customers to share the data. And this goes back to supply-demand equilibrium. If you have a constrained supply, if you sell an image for $7,000, you can only take two, then you're like, oh, if you show it to your mom, I want another $2,000 or something. You know, there's these goofy licensing schemes. We looked at it, and because we're trying to encourage people to freshly task imagery, because we have so much of it, we are pushing open licensing. So you can buy an image from us, put it on Twitter. You can say how bad it is.
Are there any commercial restrictions to the reuse of that data?
No. You put in our, I mean, there are, it's a CC by 04. So it's Creative Commons by 04. You have to credit it to us. And you can sell it. You can put it on coffee mugs. It's fine.
I would imagine that there's some kind of export controls on that data based on the fact that you've mentioned you don't work with, you know, certain governments.
Personal choice. There is no restriction on our what we can sell. But we just choose not to do it.
You've mentioned already that about 50% of your revenue is with the U.S. government and another 25% is with foreign allied governments. On different occasions, I've read company announcements about Umbra being awarded various government contracts. And I'm kind of curious, why are these different contractual vehicles necessary? Why don't governments just self-serve like other clients?
It's a big government. I mean, like they use different budgets. So like what NASA's looking at is very different than what NRO is looking at. The use cases are very different than the budgets are very different. One thing that I know for sure is aggregating the procurement of data in one place eliminates all competition from from all the agencies, and you wind up getting the worst product and everyone who wants the data doesn't get it. So like if you have one agency that's collecting all the tasks for the entire government, guess what? Whatever agency with a bigger budget than you is going to always beat you out and bump you for your task. So allowing the procurement of satellite data to be disaggregated is forces more competition between the agencies. It also forces more competition in the public markets. So when the government intervenes in the free market, you wind up having really negative outcomes for the government. And they know that. The government's not dumb. So, you know, people always complain about the government. I think that their process is not bad, generally.
Aside from government work, the company has also been a major advocate for unlocking new sort of non-traditional commercial use cases. And you've done this by making it easy to task satellites, you price very fairly, and you even give data away for free. Since having launched the company, which new commercial use cases have most surprised you?
Most surprised me? I was kind of prepared for, I have seen really cool things from the data. Like the first time a group of emperor penguins was ever imaged from space was from one of our satellites. I know that we've mapped more deforestation than any other provider provided the data for free. I think it's probably more use cases than specific, like we have like all kinds of hedge funds that do it. And they're like, I'm going to short this stock. It sucks. Like we were looking at a mine in our open data and it's on there now. We look at it, I think, every day. And somebody discovered the wall of the mine fall in and they put it on the internet, like to Twitter. Like if this stock is publicly traded, it's going to be a problem.
It's striking to me that remote sensing today is a bit like GPS 30 or 40 years ago, because it's tech that was originally built by the military for the military. But as government opened up access to the public and as companies started producing smaller, faster, and cheaper receivers, commercial activity just exploded. And today, GPS underpins literally a majority of the economy, from agriculture to finance to telecom. Do you think that kind of analogy is useful when thinking about the future of your industry?
Well, mapping has been around forever, right? So cartography is like an essential thing, which is you kind of have insights, right? Which is like quickly getting an image of a moment in time. And then you have mapping, where you would maybe use interferometry or something like that to better understand an area or build a building. The mapping market's a very different market than the, like, I need an image quickly of this thing market. But the price has got to come down. So if you look at the mapping industry, so if I'm a mom and pop company and I use a theodolite to measure a bridge, you see the guys, the construction workers looking through the little theodolite, and you're doing all kinds of measurements. Like that marginal cost is probably $200 an hour to pay him and to lunch and drive out somewhere. If you can reduce the cost and provide the same insight below $200 an hour, then I think you're going way beyond kind of the traditional market that everyone talks about, which is like cutting across some parking lots or doing stuff for the military. The real growth in the market is the least sexy thing in the entire world, which is like it has the like hill by this pipeline shifted. Is this, we need to do a survey of a bridge every year and see if it has subsided, as the dam subsided. So it's really unsexy things, but the market for it is like over $100 billion. And $100 billion is very sexy to me. So.
Okay, well, having talked a bit about what you're building, I'd like to shift gears slightly and talk about how Umbra was built, which from what I understand is something that greatly influenced what the company ultimately became. Early on, you and your co-founder, David, made the decision to bootstrap the company rather than take on early stage venture capital funding. Why was that the right path for you?
I encourage everyone to do it. I mean, the best thing that you can ever do is take as much risk on yourself. You know, we have that, what we did was buy time. So because we were bootstrapping ourselves, we were able to make mistakes ourselves and be accountable to only ourselves. Now, if we make a mistake, we've got shareholders who get all upset. But that time where we were able to make mistakes and learn and make mistakes and learn again, allowed us to iterate on a satellite system that now has proven to be far superior. If when we were two guys in a garage, we had taken money for our first design, we probably would only be able to take a couple of images over a high demand area daily. But because we had no incentive to rush it. So if the day an investor gives you a dollar, it is get to space, get an exit. Like that clock ticks. And you have to understand the incentives of an investor. VCs have LPs, and the LPs and the VCs need what's called IRR, internal rate of return. And time kills IRR. So what we did without investment is took off as much risk as possible with our own money and our own time. So when we took money, our time to market was much faster than anyone else. So the invested capital has had a much, much higher return. It also allowed us to iterate on the technology, which is, has shown to be much better.
Yeah, it's striking to me that bootstrapping in general is a pretty under-discussed phenomenon in mm-hmm. startup culture. And as a sort of proxy measure of that, in all his years of writing, Paul Graham has only mentioned bootstrapping in 3 of his essays. And in a tweet from earlier this year, he touched on something you were just discussing when he said, quote, "Bootstrapping is a proper subset of taking venture funding. Taking venture funding lets a company choose its growth rate. One end of this continuum is to raise $0 and just take whatever default growth rate you can get off your own revenues." It sounds like you disagree with that.
Yeah, no, that's very dumb. So maybe that works for Paul Graham, who's, I presume, is an investor, right? He's probably a very famous investor. Okay.
Yeah, he previously launched Y Combinator or ran Y Combinator.
Okay. So Paul Graham is highly incentivized to give people at the earliest stages money. And YC, I think it's they get 12%, something like that. If we had gone to YC, so an investor is incentivized to have as much equity of a highly successful company as possible, right? A founder is incentivized to have as much equity as a highly successful company as possible. So what bootstrapping did was gave us a choice in who, because we had taken so much risk off the table. So we had built the radar, proved that the 1200 megahertz worked, because every single scientist, every single smart person in the world was like, no way, there's no way. There's no way two guys in a garage can do this. And if they do, it's going to cost $10 million. We did, our first radar cost $1,200. Excluding the atomic clock. And and now you have, I don't want to pick on anyone, but if you look at the equity of the common stock versus the preferred in essentially any space company, remote sensing company, the people at Umbra have the most percentage ownership relative to anyone else. And, the reality is that if I have a company that is very highly valued, I think there's only one other commercial remote sensing company that has a higher valuation than us. And if we make all the money and I get to live a great life and my kids go to private school and do whatever, have cool cars and I'm wrong, that's fine. I'm fine being wrong. But what Paul Graham is saying is very much is the way that a VC talks. But Paul also isn't investing in super hard tech, right? It may make a lot of sense for a software company that can move really, really fast to take a lot of money very early to grow, scale, and exit within an extremely short period of time and provide their investors IRR, super high IRR. The way that a space company produces high IRR is by making as much money as possible. So because the time to market is so long, because you have to build the satellite, design it, it's a whole thing. It's years. It is not you can't just push code. It is years. The kind of the only way you can do it is by being a winner, like and really winning and meaningfully changing a market.
I think the hardware software distinction is the difference that might make the difference there.
I still think he's wrong, because you could also have a really great software company, and if you push the software and you make a bunch of money and don't need VC and just like have billions of dollars, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's still a win. We'll take it.
We'll win. It's fine. Like, ask the Instagram guys. They're fine. Or the WhatsApp guys.
Umbra did eventually accept VC funding. So is the lesson here that for a certain class of startups, it's best to bootstrap the prototyping phase, but venture fund the growth phase? Or is that an oversimplification?
Okay. Every company is going to be different. Also, everyone's circumstances are going to be different. So David and I were late in our careers. I mean, how old was I? It's maybe like 28, 29. Maybe I was 30. God, how old am I? Okay. Yeah, I was 30. David was like 30. So we already had 10 years of experience. We already had made money. We were able to like go a long period of time without money. You can't really do that if you're 21. But I would definitely, the more time you can spend learning on your own and not learning with other people's money is going to give you some kind of an advantage.
Okay, one final question on the VC ecosystem. Traditional VCs have a pretty mixed track record when it comes to aerospace and defense, but it is notable that today's venture ecosystem is very different from what it used to be back in 2015 when you and David launched Umbra. And in particular, I'm thinking about the renewed interest in deep tech by a pretty successful, intelligent cohort of investors. If you were advising a young startup today in a similar position to you when you launched Umbra, should they consider raising money from day one?
They should consider it, but I don't think they should do it. I don't know how successful VCs have been in defense tech. As somebody I have done like a lot of investing ever since I was a kid. I always liked it. I don't know that VCs really understand defense tech. So without saying anything bad about anyone, you have an industry in Silicon Valley where like the vast majority of the VCs are, and we don't have any money from Silicon Valley. So I can say this without offending anyone, on our cap table, their experience of working with the government is like having Microsoft sell software to DOD. It is not like selling a missile to DOD, which is very, very different. The way that you sell a missile to DOD, let me restart. If I'm a college student and I think I have a real cool idea and I'm in Silicon Valley and I go through some accelerator and get a bazillion dollars, all the VCs are going to think it's cool. I'm going to think it's cool. Like I invented the Batmobile. It's so cool. And then DOD goes, what the fuck am I going to do with the Batmobile? Like it's cool, but I mean, there's like no need. So unless you understand the needs of the government, which is really, really difficult because they're not going to tell you, they kind of can't, then you won't really know what to build. So that goes back to an advantage where David had spent 10 years in industry working on advanced satellite systems. And if we had started the company when we were both 21, we would have come up with a really cool satellite maybe, but probably not one that could make money and probably not one that the government liked. So VCs who've done a very good job making a lot of money in software still have a lot to learn about the government procurement process. I look at a lot of VCs. I have seen their investments. I know a lot of the end users, and I don't know how great some of those investments are going to turn out. But what I will say is that if you index on defense over the next decade, you probably will not lose money because the world is not getting any safer. And in order to have a competitive edge, you have to have something that is not only better than what is in the architecture, but that is lower cost, widely proliferated, and scalable. And the only place that that's going to come from is startups. So you're going to find winners and losers, and that's all part of the game, and that's okay. But the key is you have to be able to continue to play the game, which means make money.
It sounds like you are not especially optimistic of the sort of new product-led approach to sales to the DoD, which is kind of the mirror image of the traditional contract-led, requirements-driven sales to the DoD. Do you think that that's an approach, a go-to-market strategy that defense tech startups should drop?
Well, so long as the government is not buying stuff that way, it probably is not the best way to do it. The government has a very, and everyone's going to hate me for saying this, a very smart procurement system. So if you have a B2B SaaS company and you are selling something for $5 to a liquor store, that's not really, the liquor store can make a mistake. DoD can kind of make mistakes, but not really. The IC, the intelligence community, can't make any mistakes. So they have a very, very slow by design process. And this goes back to IRR. So it's like you get a phase one and then a phase two and then a phase three. And you work very slowly proving that you can actually deliver over long periods of time. And then you become a program of record. And then, you know, you get your windfall. But it is a slow process, which is, you know, in direct opposition with VC, which needs high IRR. And if you have to wait 3 years to go and get a $100 million contract after spending $300 or $400 million, and you know the company's value is only $500 million, it'll obliterate your IRR.
If I had to play devil's advocate on that point of slow procurement, I think several of these startups would argue that that is outdated and doesn't match the tempo of current conflicts.
I mean, good. You change the government. Go lob. Go be a congressman. But like the reality is, like, this goes back to, like, I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm not saying that a startup is wrong. If they have a great product, it should be adopted quickly in with the government. But what I'm saying is the government cannot be scammed, or really shouldn't be scammed. And it just, the way that you do it is you force everyone to prove it. And believe me, before we had satellites and before I had gone through the system, I was really ticked off that we were losing contracts. And as a founder, you're looking at your greater vision, right? Like, this could be so great. And DoD's like, I need it now. And I'll buy it. And when I buy it, it's not going to be a lot. That being said, once you get in, the money flows. Like, I mean, the money really, really flows if you have a great product.
You've, stepping back to your investors, you've mentioned it already that your earliest backers were not from traditional Silicon Valley backgrounds. One of those early backers was John Burbank, which I think is really interesting, because he's not a traditional venture capitalist. He's best known as a macro hedge fund investor, which means that he spent a long time thinking about sweeping long-term trends unfolding in the economy, but also information advantage, just deeply understanding the value of knowing more sooner. Given that unique perspective, what do you think he saw in Umbra that others might have missed?
You Googled John. So the I would describe John as an information vampire. The reason why he was so successful and continues to be successful is an uncanny ability to absorb information. So, like, synthetic aperture radar, commercial remote sensing is like, if I, you know, went to USC and got an MBA and then now I'm a VC, I'm not going to go and try and understand the physics of commercial remote sensing. But John was willing to do it. And John was, like, willing to learn and understand what we were doing, like principally, like, he actually understands it. Like, I can talk to him, like, or David can talk to him, and he is very knowledgeable. Like, he's obviously extremely intelligent. I think what he saw, and this goes back to bootstrapping, is that David, who is obviously very intelligent, right? He's the brains behind Umbra. He, you know, runs a company. He's a CEO. We've been friends since high school. John also made an assessment in human capital, which is you're probably not going to find two guys who've been friends for so long. We've been friends for a really long time who were committed with all their own money for years. And then not only bootstrap, but like we're so open to learning. And that I think that John made a bet, because it's a bet, all startup investment on the founders of the company. And then also a bet on his understanding of the technology, which has proven to be correct. But John is like an incredible, prolific investor, right? You have all the smart money went to our competitors. Our competitors have big name brand investors. They've taken 3-4x the amount of money that we have, or that we raised. And he looked at Umbra purely from first principles. He wasn't like, well, did so and so do it? Like, did so and so make this investment? Because he understood fundamentally that we, because of our relationship with the government, that we had information that nobody else had, which was like, what is it interesting to the government? And I think he made a linear bet on information.
You've given me a perfect segue to my next question. Today, John is fully committed to investing in early stage startups. And in a previous interview, I heard him describe his transition into VC as being motivated by this secular trend he believes to have spotted in the realm of, you said it, human capital. He wants to be investing in tech because that's where the young, talented people are going. And that brings me to my final question. In a previous interview, you were asked about your background and shared that because you didn't attend a big name university, you felt like you had to go the founder route and sort of make it on your own, saying that, quote, you have a clear line where everyone is told to follow this line. Go to school, get into debt, get good grades, get an MBA, then go be a banker or a VC. Anyone who breaks from that tends to have outsized success or winds up going to jail. Now that you find yourself at the helm of a leading tech company, how has your past informed the way that you grow your team and help you spot the potential for outsized success in other people?
So that sounds like something I would say, because it is something that I believe. So to dig in a little bit on that, like, because I've always thought and learned very different. I am deeply contrarian. I force myself to think. I started something I picked up from John. I started reading, which I went to Chico State, which is a well-known party school. This is a great school. I highly recommend it, but not known for their academics. But I started reading a book a week, which has been like, it's very hard. Like, it is very hard to make that commitment. I listen to it in my commute. But if you force yourself to learn, you're going to force yourself. If you learn from, like, you have all these great, highly intelligent people have written books for like 1,000 years. You can draw off that. You can draw off that learning to make decisions that are not the decisions that you're supposed to make. I was on a panel with like 3 highly successful people, and I was the only one who went to college. and definitely the poorest. So like I think that what I said is true. If you break out from the system, and that doesn't mean you have to go and start a space company with the radar satellite that can see through a cloud. I mean, it could be as simple as starting a liquor store and doing it really, really well. You'll have an outsized outcome. The guy who owns a liquor store probably makes as much money as a doctor. And he probably has a way more flexible schedule. I mean, he's got 5 liquor stores. He probably takes a nicer vacation than a doctor. So I think that if you break from what society tells you, there is a real opportunity for outsized outcomes. But I guess your question is like, what do we look for? We have on our website a culture document, and it's like 10 things. And they're not like 10 things that we got off the internet. They're 10 things that we learned. And we learn them through growth. And we learn them through people. And what's fundamental about it is what I like to call, and everyone's going to yell at me if like we don't swear at the company, is a no asshole policy. But being an asshole comes in many shapes and sizes. One is like being a know-it-all, saying, oh, I know the best way to do this. And it's like, well, actually, we're the first people to do this. We don't know, like David designed this on math, like on the Excel sheet. So this like humility as a founder, where the like David and I both will go into any situation always and say, I may not know the answer. Here's my hypothesis to the right answer. If you have a different answer, or if you have a different solution, we're willing to learn. And I see a lot of arrogance out of young people in Silicon Valley who like, sure, it's deserved. Like you got the best grades and you went to college and you started a space company and you're super smart. But if you don't have that humility and you're not willing to learn, then it becomes really difficult to succeed. And in almost all industries, like you can be wrong a lot, but if you're right one time, like you can be wrong and you can fix it. But if you're right one time and you hit the market perfectly, that's all you ever need.
Great answer. Well, Gabe, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your story with us. And thank you for having been a guest on the Splinter Podcast.
This is awesome. Thank you.